Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 95. Seems to be taking forever to get to 100, but I will get there eventually, allowing for truck accidents and very, very bad biopsies. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, we are still on the A to Z project, and we are doing the letter O. Now, there's a number of things I could have done with O. I was going to do O Lucky Man, but I can't find my copy of it because after the renovations, of which have now become famous and legendary, there is a room called the study. Now, that's as opposed to the library where I am now, and it's full of stuff. And somewhere in there is a copy of Lindsay Anderson's Oh Lucky Man. I haven't been able to put my fingers on it. There's a whole bunch of other shit in there. We are intending to clean it up, just like we are the other bedroom, but at the moment we haven't, so... Oh, Lucky Man's on the list, but I'm not doing it as part of the letter O. What I was then going to do is replace it with Our Man in Havana, with the movie with Alec Guinness, Noel Coward, Ernie Kovacs in it. But my copy of it spat the dummy at me and wouldn't let me play it. So that seemed to be a bit of a dead loss. So I went back onto a classic. Now, basically, I'll tell you the other film, and then I'll tell you what I've replaced those two films with. The other film I'm doing is an Australian film from 1946 called The Overlanders, directed by an English guy called Harry Watt, and starring John William Pilbeam Goffage. Most people know him as Chips Rafferty. And it's a very Australian story, and some of it takes place in the Northern Territory, a place, as we all know, I am quite fond of. And I thought I'd do that. The good thing is that that film is on YouTube, so I am going to embed The Overlanders onto the paleo-cinema.blogspot.com website, or just paleo-cinema.com if you want to take the quick link. So you'll be able to watch the film after I talk about it, so... I really like the fact that some old films are now becoming available on YouTube. One of the Dr. Mabuse films was as well. So that's kind of useful for me. It's something I want to encourage. I love the idea of being able to talk about a film and, in my own way, make it accessible to you guys and ladies listening. So, yeah, that's it. And so that's what I'm doing, The Overlanders. It's an epic story of a 1,500-mile cattle run. A 1,000 head of cattle being taken by 6 people across the centre of Australia for 1,500 miles. Not kilometres, but miles. So that's a bit of fun. And the one that I replaced the previous two films with after epic fails on both of them is the original 1960 Ring-a-Ding-Ding Rat Pack Ocean's 11. I just thought I'd get that in there, and it's very cool, it's very suave, there are lots of people smoking, there's Frank Sinatra in a orange mohair sweater, and it's just a bit of a gag, and of course it inspired Steven Soderbergh to make 3 movies. So, how is everybody? Things here are going fine, we're just chilling out, we've finally got the splashbacks in the kitchen, but the guy came to do the splashbacks, so I happened to be home that day, and they hadn't cut out the holes where the PowerPoints go in the splashbacks. So they're going to have to come back in 2 weeks and do the rest. So basically, it's like an endless... It's like the last Lord of the Rings movie where you have a whole bunch of climaxes. That's what our renovation's like. It just getting beyond a joke. So hopefully in 2 weeks' time, that'll be that. I've had a few people over anyway, just chilling out, eating a meal, grooving along and things like that. So it's nice to be able to get back to that thing where we can invite people over. And that's what we've been doing. The radio gig is going ahead well. I did Nightmare Alley. I recorded Nightmare Alley last week with Ivor. And this week I went in and... And we did All About Eve, which is a lot of fun. I realise I podcasted about it not too long ago, but there's always going to be a bit of overlap there. But the film, re-watching it this time, it really, really struck me on how very, very funny it is. And I don't think it struck me quite as funny when I talked about it on the podcast. Just the beautiful bitchy dialogue and all that sort of thing, so... Ivor and I both had fun with that. Next week I'm recording It's a Mad, 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 Mad World for the radio, and I'm going to enjoy that too because there's just so many, it's rich in all those cameos and things like that. And Yeah, so the radio gig is going apace and a lot of fun, and it keeps me out of pubs on a Friday night. So what else have I been watching? I actually watched another Australian film, another classic Australian film from 1955, Jeddah, which was Charles Chauvel's last film, starring Rosalie Monks and Robert Tadawale. Sorry if you're an Aboriginal person, I should have done a little warning on speaking the names of dead people, but I'm sorry about that. But yeah, really interesting. Unfortunately, the film process they use for the colour photography is a little bit dodgy. But yeah, it's a beautiful story. It's very much of its time. There are some bits now that we might find a bit racist, particularly in the female station manager's character. But it's good that somebody in 1955 wanted to tell an Aboriginal story, and a story of the clash between the different cultures. And as that, it is quite a landmark movie in Australian cinema. And at some stage, I may well talk about it on the podcast. Let's see what I saw. Watched a really bad movie from the Sci-Fi Channel called Swamp Volcano, about a volcano in Miami. Less said about that, the better. Let's see what else I saw. Did see The Deadly Bees, an English Amicus film from the 1960s, starring Guy Dolman. And, yeah, that was a lot of fun. Yeah, Deadly Bees. It also had Frank Finlay in it. A little bit of fun. Not too bad. Very schlocky, very B-movie cast. I'm not sure whether Vince and the team and Mary and Nick over there have done that movie. If not, they probably will at some stage. But I did see Splice, the recent science fiction movie starring Sarah Polley and Adrian Brody. And yeah, I liked it. It's a usual science horror kind of thing. Really had a nice third act twist in it, which I kind of appreciated. And yeah, it's good to see a good dramatic, sort of scientifically accurate science fiction story told. So if you haven't seen Splice, I'm recommending that. Did see a South Korean film, Two Tidal Wave, also called Hyundai, which is really weird because I thought that was a kind of car. But anyway, it's a disaster film. It's a South Korean disaster film. And the special effects are very spectacular. I'm not sure they're as smooth as a lot of Hollywood special effects, but if you want to check it out, Tidal Wave is an interesting, epic film, and really kind of goes in, does the character piece. It's very much following the model of 1970s Hollywood disaster movies. In, you know, you build the characters up and then you blast them flat with some disaster. And so they did that. So that was kind of cool. Let's see what else I saw worth noting. I did see a movie called Wild Target with Bill Nye and Martin Freeman and a couple of other people, including Rupert Grint from the Harry Potter movies. It's basically Bill Nye plays a middle-aged, very gentlemanly hitman who is supposed to knock off Emily Blunt, but he falls in love with her. And it's kind of one of those, it's almost an Ealing comedy kind of feel to it with gory twists to it, so I do like that one. It was a bit of fun. It's nothing fantastic. It's not gut-wrenchingly funny or anything like that, but it's a nice little comedy of manners almost, which was quite good. What else did I see? I did see A Foreign Affair, the Billy Wilder movie with Marlene Dietrich. It's set in post-war Germany during the Allies occupation of various parts of Berlin. And yeah, that movie is very, very interesting. It's has a lot to say about, of course, Billy Wilder being an expatriate German. It does have a lot to say about post-war Germany. It's a lot more accurate to what was actually going on in post-war Germany than you might have seen in a kind of straight Hollywood film. Marlene Dietrich is superb in it. It's got some great location shooting in and around Berlin at the time. And, it's very much worth checking out. It's not as well remembered as movies like Sunset Boulevard and Ace in the Hole and things like that. But it's a very, very interesting piece of cinema, and it doesn't play the party line as far as American politics are concerned, to the extent that a lot of other studio films at the time did. And if you haven't checked it out, definitely worth your time and attention. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies. I'll probably do The Overlanders first, but I'll just play a little bit of music and then we'll get into it.
Do you enjoy movies like Carnival of Souls, The Mole People, Black Sunday, and The Tingler? Do you find yourself late at night reading magazines such as Film Max, Chiller Theater, or Monster Bash? Do you love vintage television programs like Sky King, Outer Limits, and The Time Tunnel? Do you find yourself surfing the net looking for the next monster movie festival or expo? Do you enjoy hearing anecdotes, cinematic details, and unusual insights into some of your favorite movies? If you answered yes to any of the above, you're encouraged to join your host, Vince Rotolo, as he examines some of the latest horror, sci-fi, and cult theatrical releases, new DVDs to add to your collection, and of course, the old classics, both good and bad. He even interviews people throughout B-Moviedom. So tune into B-MovieCast at bmoviecast.com.
Resistance is futile.
Those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft. And I've got no defense for it, the heat is too intense for it. What good would common sense for it do? 'Cause it's witchcraft, wicked witchcraft. And although I know it's strictly taboo, when you arouse the need in me, my heart says yes, indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. It's such an ancient pitch, but one I wouldn't switch, 'cause there's no nicer witch than you.
'Cause it's witchcraft,
a witchcraft,
witchcraft,
a witchcraft. When you arouse the need in me, my heart says yes, indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. It's such an ancient pitch, one I wouldn't switch, 'cause there's no nicer witch than you. 'Cause there's no nicer witch than you. Don't go in there, please. Come on home.
That was George Maharis singing Witchcraft. I got this kind of thing for closeted gay actors in the 1960s who do albums. George Takiris did one, George Maharis did one. There are any number of them that did, singing romantic love songs and things like that. So there's Maharis. Not too bad. I think he's a pretty good actor as well. But, so Witchcraft. There's an album called George Maharis Sings. If you type that into Google, you might find a slightly subterranean version of it available to you at no charge. But anyway, let's get on to The Overlanders.
In 1942, the Japanese were driving invincibly southward from Singapore. It seemed inevitable that next into their hands would fall the northern territory of Australia, largest undeveloped region in the world, with 1 million head of cattle and a population of only 5,000 whites. Space, scorched earthen space, was Australia's final weapon. But first, the vast herds of the north must be saved. And so across Australia moved a mass migration unique in history. From small beginnings, the mobs of cattle poured south in an almost unending flood. This is the story of one mob and of the people who drove it across a continent.
Yeah, you've got to see that that's a movie of its time when they talk about there being 10,000 whites in the Northern Territory. At that stage of Australia's history, black Australians didn't have the right to vote and didn't even have citizenship, and there were immense numbers of restrictions on them, which were basically human rights violations. I won't try to brush over that. They couldn't drink, they couldn't travel without permission, any money that they earned was controlled by the government. It was just a bad situation in general. But leaving that aside, that's basically the story. Bunch of drovers are at Wyndham, at the top part of Western Australia. Everybody's doing the scorched earth thing. They're burning down houses and farmhouses and things like that. They're getting rid of the processing centres at Wyndham, the slaughterhouses and things, getting all the machinery out of there before the Japanese come. They never did come, but you know, before they thought the Japanese were going to come. And also, they had orders to slaughter all the cattle. But one drover, a guy called Dan McAlpine, played by Chips Rafferty in this movie, decided that he was going to drive 1,000 head of cattle from Western Australia to the Queensland coast, which is about 1,500 miles. If you're driving it on a highway at 100 kilometres an hour, about 3.5 days travel, but 6 months travel if you're herding cattle and you've got to go across some of the worst territory in the country and in some ways in the world. And that's the story of this, that immense cattle drive going across the country to stop the Japanese from getting hold of the resources represented by these cattle. And it's a good story. It's a really rollicking story. Had a really weird genesis, this movie. A Scottishman called Harry Watt, who was working for Ealing at the time, and he'd done documentaries during and before World War II, and this is 1946. So I've actually got a thing that he wrote for the Penguin Film Review, number 9, in the early 1950s. I've actually got a copy of it for some reason. And Sir Michael Balcon, who was running Ealing at the time, sent him out to Australia on spec to see if it was possible to make films there, and if so, to make one. Now, I'll just read a bit of what Harry Watt says in this. We had no set plans, no ideas. We agreed I should take 3 months seeing the country. That, of course, just showed how little we knew about it. In 5 months, I travelled 25,000 miles and had only investigated 3 states with any thoroughness. And during that 5 months, I'd had 5 ideas and scrapped the lot. I was influenced, of course, by what I found going on in the film industry in Australia. In 1944, there was only one film being made, Rats of Tobruk, a reconstruction of the part played by the Australians during the Siege of Tobruk. As this seemed to be an excellent subject and was getting complete cooperation in its making from the army, I decided against trying to compete with another war subject. Rats of Tobruk was being directed by Charles Chauvel, one of the two established directors in Australia who made the only Australian film to have much prestige abroad, 40,000 Horsemen. So basically, Harry Watt went out there, and they had immense amounts of trouble getting the Overlanders made. For a start, they were constantly called upon to advise government departments on their documentary films. He had to go from bureaucracy to bureaucracy to get permission to make the film. They had trouble sourcing technicians because the Australian technicians were either working for the Commonwealth Film Unit, which did documentaries, or there just weren't any. And even just getting cameras was a big problem. They had to run around Sydney trying to find the camera equipment they needed to make this film. Then they had to get on small puddle jumper aeroplanes that were available at the time and get all this stuff out to where they needed to film the movie. And it was an immense problem for Watt and for Chips Rafferty, the star, who had made a few movies, including Rats of Tobruk. The two cameras they needed they actually found in a businessman's safe where it was being held against a bad debt. They travelled the whole route that the movie Cattle Drive takes, just scouting locations and working out what they needed to do. And let's see, we had two tiny offices shared with the Ealing distribution man, who had long ago decided we were mad. This is Harry Watt again. We were besieged by the usual masses of crackpots who turned up whenever the film was going to be made. The passages were crowded with children showing off their dancing, and in the streets outside, men waited with performing dogs and horse dealers paraded their wares. Films were a rarity in Australia, and our life was made hell. And basically, they ended up not even getting professional filmmakers, but enthusiastic amateurs who were hard working to make this film with. It was an enormous labour of love, in a sense. And Harry Watts showing the people back in England at Ealing that he could actually do it. And he made two more films in Australia as a result of that, being Eureka Stockade in 1949 and The Siege of Pinchgut in 1959. And I've talked about The Siege of Pinchgut before in the podcast. So he had immense trouble getting everything together. It was just, we were basically the sticks at that stage. Our film industry collapsed just before the war, when governments and film distribution, well, people who owned the cinema chains, cut deals with American studios, which kind of cut out Australian studios from making movies. But let's get back to the movie for a bit. Basically, it can be seen as a Western. It was incredibly popular in England when it was released in 1946. And the movie does have a lot of great action scenes, and it was a very alien landscape to the audiences watching it, even some of the ones in Australia. The crew that Chips Rafferty's character, Dan McAlpine, gets together is interesting. There's a sailor who's fed up with the sea, and so they decide to call him Sinbad. He's kind of like the male hunk of the movie, and it falls in love with one of the farmers, one of the property owner's daughters, played by Daphne Campbell, who only ever acted in this film. She wasn't a particularly good actress, and her voice was dubbed by an English actress when it got to England, but she was pretty and she could ride a horse well, so they gave her the gig. And and there's a guy called Corky, who's very kind of Shakespearean and over the top, a little chubby comic relief kind of character. There are a few other drovers. There are the parents of the Daphne Campbell character who come along. Basically, the mother comes along as a cook, the father comes along as a drover. And there's an Aboriginal drover, and there were a lot of Aboriginal cattle drovers, and of course there still are. And basically these people go through immense problems. They run out of water at one stage and have to drive the cattle across a high mountain pass. They lose a lot of cattle, and when they get to the top of the pass, they find a tree blocking the path. And the Aboriginal driver, Jackie, which is a little bit of a cliched name, it's a little bit kind of politically incorrect as a name, climbs up the cliff face with a rope to assist in getting the blockage out of the way. So he has a heroic part to play. And he's treated just like one of the other characters, which is kind of rare for a movie of the time to be like that, where he was just part of the ensemble. And these days we think nothing of that, but for Harry Watt and the other people making the film to treat an Aboriginal actor and an Aboriginal character as an equal to the others, and he was getting paid the same as everybody else was as well, his character in the movie. So basically, that honesty and that recognition of the contribution that Indigenous Australians made to the development of the country is one of the reasons why I really like this film. It does have an honesty about it that really is welcome and is a part of the history of our cinema at this stage. But I'll just play a couple of little bits that I've got from The Overlanders, just to kind of give you a bit of an idea of how it plays.
The one thing we've plenty of in Australia is space. So why not use it, like the Russians did? Scorched earth and space.
What about the cattle, Bert?
Just shoot them where they are. I've got some ammo for you here somewhere.
I'm not going to shoot those cattle, Bert.
It makes some fine dinners for the Japs.
I won't leave them for the Japs, boy. I'll overland them.
You'd never get through, Dan. Look, this was just to stop you from committing suicide. We're here. You'd either have to make for Adelaide or Queensland. Adelaide is 2,000 miles away. Queensland is 1,500.
I make for Queensland.
All right. And when you cross the Orge, you'd be out of feed and water. It's terrible country. You know how long the Duraks were coming here? 3 years. The war would be over then.
You can't tell me there haven't been any big movements of cattle since the Duraks.
Listen, Bert, when I went down to Halls Creek to enlist, the sergeant there, Patterson, he said to me, in this war, bullocks are more important than bullets. You stick to cattle, he said, and you'll be doing a better job for Australia than bashing your spine in some army camp. Then he knocked me back. I was the only recruit that day, so we went out and got drunk. But I've never forgotten what he said. Bullocks are more important than bullets.
He was right, in a way, but...
But you want me to leave 1,000 head of cattle to rot? If I can get a plant together, will you let me have a go?
I'd have to have an official okay.
Ah, oh, don't give me that line of bull, Bert. You know you've got authority for all I need. Will you back me?
I can't stop you, Dan. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a personal contract and try and have it okayed when I go south.
Good on you, Bert. I know you wouldn't let me down.
And then there's a bit where he's recruiting drivers to help him with the cattle run, and he talks to the Aboriginal driver, Jackie, who was played by a guy called Clyde Combo. This is one of the funniest bits of the movie, and I love the line delivery of it. I'll just play it for you. It's funny.
You'll come with me, won't you, Jackie?
Where to, boss?
Across three states, Western Australia, Northern Territory, and Queensland to the sea.
How long the road, boss?
For a year, maybe two.
Okay, I'll come with you. Wait till I tell the missus. I'll be back in 5 minutes.
I'll be back in 5 minutes. I just love that stuff. It's crazy good. So I do like this film. I like the fact that it's part of my country's history. Now, of course, the film was made by English people rather than Australians, and even though it does have a predominantly Australian cast, a lot of the post-production was done in England. And in that sense, it's not really an Australian film, but it does tell an Australian story, and I do like it very much for that reason. I like that fact that it tells the history of where I live and the kind of people who came before me in this crazy life. And even though it is kind of dramatized and things like that, people did stuff like that during the war. There are immense numbers of stories of kind of ordinary heroism, which really don't get enough of a look in. I mean, spectacular stories do, but this one where basically people herd cattle across crocodile-infested rivers and through deserts and have to stop them from stampeding into a waterhole so half of them will die if they do in the mud. And just the bravery and the kind of everyday getting the job done kind of know-how and guts is one of the reasons why I really do like this film. It's a strong film. It's not perfect, and it was filmed under very difficult circumstances, and it's the sort of film you don't really want to remake. Well, you don't really want to remake most movies, but leaving that aside, it's one you don't really want to remake because it was made a couple of years after the story took place, 3 years at most, 3-4 years. And it's really of its time, and it shows what life in the country was like, to the fact that to call the Flying Doctor Service, which is a doctor in an airplane came down and looked after patients, people had to use a pedal radio. There was no electricity around, so basically they had to pedal a radio set up to make the radio work so they could communicate with the outside world. And there were thousands of these pedal radios in tiny communities all across the country. And for a year at a time, that was the only communication they had with the outside world, is these incredibly primitive radio sets. And there's still a lot of that kind of spirit when you do travel to the Northern Territory. They've still got that kind of, you know, getting the job done toughness that I really do like. And it's something that I grew up with, in a sense, in the kind of economically depressed areas of Sydney and the people that I talked to. And I did visit the country on holidays and fairly deep into the country at Nevatar and Warren in central New South Wales. And a lot of these same types of characters were out there at the time, so I've got a direct connection with the characters in this film in a sense. And I do think that it's one of those movies that, if were the funds available, it really could do with a bit of a brush up and a bit of a digital reconstruction. And really, it's an important film in that sense, because it is historically based. It's got one of our great iconic actors of the 20th century, and it's Chips Rafferty. Never a fantastically nuanced and varied actor, but what he did very well, and he kind of represented a certain kind of Australian male to a lot of us. And one of the other things I should mention too is that the two main female characters, the girl played by Daphne Campbell, whose name was Mary Parsons, and her mother, played by Jean Blue. They're strong characters as well. The female characters are strong, tough, and no bullshit about them. They do as much heroic stuff as the men do. They're tough, outback kind of women, and that is something that, in a lot of ways, before the modern times, and into the modern times too, there is a history in Australian film of strong female characters, which is really good. I'm not saying it's universal, I'm not saying every Australian film has that as a theme, but it's one of those things that is a common trait through there, the toughness of women. And they do hold their own, and this film in that sense is, even though it's very crude and black and white, and they shoot some scenes day for night, and maybe some of the editing isn't what it would be if it was a modern film, and it's got all of those limitations of its time. I think that it shows a community of people doing tough things in very trying circumstances, and just rethinking it. I rewatched it yesterday. Just thinking about it again, it's just a good adventure film, which has a little bit to say about, you know, my homeland in a sense, without waving flags too much. But that's about all I've got to say on The Overlanders. As I said, I'm going to put the link up onto the Paleo Cinema website. I'll also put it onto the Paleo Cinema Cafe in Facebook and on my personal Facebook. And people can watch the film through those portals if they choose to. But I'm going to take another break now. And when we get back, we'll talk about something a lot different, but only 14 years separated in time, being Lewis Milestone's 1960 film Ocean's 11.
Someday I'll have me a chauffeur and a block long limousine, EO11. EO11. Someday I'll have me a penthouse, stacks and stacks of folding green, EO11. EO11. It's all a state of mind, whether or not you find that place down there or heaven. In the meantime, EO11. EO11. It is all a state of mind, whether or not you find that place down there or heaven. But in the meantime, EO, EO 11, EO 11.
Okay, that was Sammy Davis Jr. singing EO 11. Right, Ocean's 11. Started out with an idea that was either... The origin of it's a little bit vague. It's either given to Dean Martin by a guy at a gas station, or it was given to Sinatra by a guy at a gas station. One way or the other, it was given to somebody by a guy at a gas station. Now, the story is that the guy, whose name, he said looking this up, was Jack Golden Russell, gave him the idea. It was played around with by George Clayton Johnson, who, amongst other things, was, of course, was a Hollywood scriptwriter and a science fiction writer as well. Lovely guy, apparently. He had a place called Cafe Frankenstein. He actually owned a cafe in Laguna Beach, and it was considered a den of iniquity. But he'd written for the Twilight Zone. He did writing for the Twilight Zone, Logan's Run, other things like that. He was kind of a beatnik hippie kind of guy. But it's really crazy that that kind of guy who's got a totally different vibe than Sinatra and the Rat Pack ended up writing the script for it. And the Rat Pack is well in established then. They were playing at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. They were booking it out. They were transgressive. They didn't give a shit. They were having a great time. Incredibly talented people all coming together in one place in friendship and just having a great time. Now, the cast of Ocean's 11. Here's the 11. Now, you know how there's a game that where you got to name all of the actors who played the Magnificent Seven. That's for amateurs. Here is your masterclass in that game, naming all the actors in Ocean's 11. You've got Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, Richard Conte, Joey Bishop, Henry Silver, a great friend of Silver and Gold podcast and The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Buddy Lester, Richard Benedict, Norman Fell, and Clem Harvey. So there's your masterclass. If you want to win a bar bet, memorize those names and then hit the bars. Now, the other people in the movie are pretty interesting as well. Angie Dickinson has a bit of a thankless role playing B. Ocean, Danny Ocean's wife. Cesar Romero has a lot of fun tearing up the scenery as Duke Santos, a retired gangster who gets involved. We've got Errol Flynn's widow, Patrice Wymore, playing Adele, who's a kind of ex-girlfriend of Danny Ocean's who tries to screw him up a lot after he kind of very politely but firmly dumps her. Ilka Chase playing Peter Lawford's mother. Very classy actress, Ilka Chase. And then we've got a few cameo roles. Akim Tamaroff, I forgot Akim Tamaroff. Great character actor, one of the best comb-over bald spot hairdos since Zero Mostel. He was actually born in Tbilisi in Russia, in Georgia. He was of Armenian instruction. He trained in the Moscow Art Theatre. And he had a great long career in Hollywood. He was in Touch of Evil. He was in, of course, this film, Ocean's 11. He was in Orson Welles' Mr. Arkadin. He was in an enormous number of movies. He's in Top Carpy, which I've talked about in the podcast, Alphaville. Yeah, just kind of a good actor and a good kind of character guy. And it's an interesting choice they made for putting him in there. And then, of course, you got cameo roles in the movie as well. I'm reading this off Wikipedia, so I don't think I'm giving you any great insights here. Shirley MacLaine, George Raft, Red Skelton. Richard Boone is the voice of the minister doing the service at the end of the movie for one of the main characters. So, yeah, basically, there's not too much to say about Ocean's 11 apart from the fact that a lot of the studio stuff and a lot of, as much as possible, the stuff was filmed at nighttime. Because what would happen is Sinatra and the Rat Pack would play the Sands, do their gig till about 1 or 2 in the morning. Then they would film. Then they would sleep. Then it would all start again. So, so I'll probably spoil a little bit of the plot. If you don't know the plot, where have you been for the last 20 years? Basically, a gang of World War II 82nd Airborne veterans are recruited by Danny Ocean and Jimmy Foster, played by Lawford, to rob 5 different Las Vegas casinos, the Sahara, the Riviera, the Desert Inn, the Sands, and the Flamingo on a single night. They planned to do it on New Year's Eve with the precision of a military operation. They need Josh Howard, played by Sammy Davis Jr., who has a job driving a garbage truck, and Sam Harmon, played by Dean Martin, entertains in one of the hotel lounges. They set it up and okay, here's why I like the movie. Let's just cut through all the shit about the plot and stuff like that. One of the groovy things about this film, and yeah, it's not a perfect film, but it's a very entertaining film because these guys were right at the center of the entertainment industry in 1960. Sinatra and Dean Martin had worked together on Some Came Running a couple of years before and become friends. They did that with Shirley MacLaine, who has a cameo in this film. Great film too, Some Came Running. I really should try to do that for a podcast at some stage if somebody doesn't beat me to it, because it is a fine drama, and it's one of those roles that shows that Dean Martin could act. There are a number of them, Rio Bravo, of course, being one of them. But Dean Martin was really... People, when he and Jerry Lewis broke up, people would not bet money on Dean Martin continuing his career. They really thought he was a second banana to Jerry Lewis and really didn't have the chops to continue on. Then he did a couple of character roles. I think he was in The Young Lions. He was in Rio Bravo. He was in Some Came Running. And really, he proved to everybody that he could be a fine actor. Now, he chose not to follow that on. He did a lot of shit in the 60s. And you know, in this one, you really see the genesis of the really suave Dean Martin persona. Just him walking through any scene with a cigarette in his hand, wearing a very fine suit. And you're not watching anything else. You know, him smoking a cigarette or picking a little bit of tobacco off his tongue or anything like that. Those little groovy moves that Dean Martin makes really make it in this film. And Sinatra, of course, walks through the role a lot. By the way, sorry about the background noise. We've got a storm blowing through now and there's a lot of rain hitting the roof. But yeah, Sinatra in this one, it isn't one of his best roles. Sinatra had already proved the point that Dean Martin was proving in his previous films, because around 1950, about 10 years before this, Sinatra couldn't get arrested in Hollywood. He really, it wasn't until he did From Here to Eternity that people really started taking him seriously. They thought he was a teenage idol and all that sort of thing from the 1940s, and his career went on the skids. He had a very unfortunate and tempestuous marriage to Ava Gardner, and by this stage in 1960, he was back on track. He'd made hit records. He'd proved his point as an actor and really didn't have anything else to prove. He really just continued on. He was enjoying himself. He was a man who also suffered from depression and had made a couple of suicide attempts, but he toughed it through, and he had that kind of New Jersey tough guy attitude to things. Bit of an asshole, I'll be honest with you. He's pretty much an asshole, but as far as charisma and being watched on the screen, these guys, Sinatra, him, Peter Lawford, who was very much a minor talent, who kind of got lucky in a couple of ways, one by marrying the sister of John F. Kennedy and the other by hanging out with the Rat Pack and Sinatra. And Sammy Davis Jr., of course, incredibly talented guy, really liked tall blondes, but then who doesn't? And yeah, he could sing, he could dance, you know, he could act, and he'd prove that himself. And yeah, he was really much, very much his own man in a world where, at a time when he had some genuine difficulties getting recognized as such, he had problems getting rooms in hotels that he was starring in as the center stage act. And things like that, with all that stupid racism. I mean, geez, why would you bother with racism? That's the other thing I want to... I'm going to go on a rant here. I don't give a fuck. Why would you bother with racism? It's just too hard. You've got to go, this person's good because of how they look and this person's not. And what about the person that's halfway through the two complexions? It's just... can't be fucked with racism. It really is something that takes way too much effort that I would rather put into something else, by making the perfect espresso or enjoying film or talking about film or cooking for friends or traveling or any number of other things. Shit like racism and sexism and discrimination based on sexuality and crap like that, it's all just too hard. I'm way too lazy for any of those things. And when you hear about stuff like that from the past, you just go, what the fuck? And I think that it's good that we've got to the stage of what the fuck with these things, and that we really do have to move on from them. And we're fortunate in most of our cases to be in societies that do embrace difference and diversity and the ability for people to be who they are without having somebody else saying, no, you can't be. And I think the work, yeah, even people like Sammy Davis Jr., who basically was an entertainer, song and dance man, pushed us towards that by just refusing to. And Sinatra himself, Sinatra really gave a lot of places in Vegas a lot of shit for discrimination. And all credit to him for that. I mean, he was a contradictory guy. Personal level, he was an asshole, but on a wider level, he actually had his heart in the right place. And you can see a bit of that in Ocean's 11 as well, the fact that the characters aren't perfect and are kind of, in a weird sense, arrested development cases. They just want to have fun with their friends. They want to make some bucks. There is a bit of complexity in a few of the characters. For instance, Bergdorf, the character played by Richard Conte, Tony Bergdorf. He's estranged from his wife. He spent some time in jail. He's got a kid in military school, and there's a nice little scene of him trying to communicate with his son, which is really touching. And Richard Conte, a fine character, terrific in The Big Combo. Years ago, I talked about The Big Combo on a podcast with Cornel Wilde and the Richard Conte. And it also had Earl Holliman and Lee Van Cleef in it. But, yeah, Richard Conte I've always liked. He's always had a kind of tough credibility about him as an actor. And in that sense, he reminds me a little bit of a guy who died only just the other day, Ben Gazzara. I should have mentioned Ben Gazzara dying too. One of my favourite actors on TV when I was growing up, because his TV series Run For Your Life was extremely cool. And I'm just dying for that one to come out on DVD. Plays a guy who's got 2 years to live and decides what he's going to do is live life to the fullest. He's a lawyer. He's got some money behind him. He just travels the earth and experiences life while he can. And I really find that a groovy TV series. So, yeah, but basically, yeah, Ocean's 11, a bunch of guys trying to relive the heyday in a sense, and they're addicted to the adrenaline of danger in a sense, as Angie Dickinson's character says to Danny Ocean. But, it's also an historic document in a sense, because a lot of it was filmed on location. They do travel through a number of casinos the way they were at that stage. And the way Las Vegas is totally different now than it was then. Everything was a lot more low-rise then and spread out. And there was still the neon and the bright lights and stuff like that. But you could see, you know, it didn't look like somebody had just chucked all the good bits from everywhere else in the world on one little chunk of desert. And, and you can see that the slot machines were a lot different than the ones now. And the ladies were dressed up really, really well. There's some really spunky chicks in this movie. But one of the things I really find a bit funny is that orange mohair sweater that Sinatra wears in one scene. And you think, no, it doesn't kind of work. I think you went a little over the top with that one, and maybe it does look a little bit too Ed Wood Jr., if you know what I mean. But, the supporting cast is good. Cesar Romero, I like. Cesar Romero was a closet case all his life. He was seen squiring around women his whole life and never touched one of them. And, he was like in his late 50s at the time of this film. And he's the only person in the film that really has a topless scene, and he looked quite fucking good for a guy in his late 50s. Very fit looking guy, and I'm sure the boys appreciated him at the time. And yeah, he had that kind of, he really knew what to bring to this film too. His swagger and confidence is the counterbalance to the swagger and confidence that Ocean's 11, the characters have. And not all of them do. It's mostly Sinatra and Dean Martin who have it, but I think Cesar Romero in that film really does balance them out nicely as far as being cool's concerned and being able to command the screen when he's on it. And of course he went on to be the Joker in Batman and tore up the scenery a lot with that, and started out as a Latin lover in the 30s, actually worked in the Merchant Marine during World War II, and later on kind of established his career again as more of a character kind of actor. He was one of those guys who was a star. He's like Fernando Lamas. Nobody remembers a movie Fernando Lamas did. I do. He did Hivero and Santee and a bunch of other films like that, but they remember him for being like an over-the-top Hollywood star, Latin lover kind of guy. Totally different career path to Anthony Quinn, though. They started out more or less the same way, Cesar Romero and Anthony Quinn. But Quinn actually went on to be an actor, and because he didn't keep the Latin lover looks he started out with and ended up with more of a Mexican peasant look to his face, he kind of went into the acting part of things and continued on for that. I don't think I've done a movie with Anthony Quinn, and I've really got to amend that because I do like him as an actor, and it'd be nice to do maybe a double pack of Anthony Quinn movies at some stage for the podcast. maybe with a guest on as well, we can look at a couple of films like that too. And I'm determined for the next podcast, I'm going to get somebody else to Skype in and chat about this stuff too, because I'm finding that I enjoy it. I mean, one of the things that the gig, the radio gig with Ivor, has really brought to me is that I like playing off somebody else when I do the podcast. It's not going to always happen, and I don't have the ability to organize myself very well. And so it's sometimes just me sitting down here with the rain teeming on the roof as it is now and talking about films. But I do enjoy that, and I think I want to mix things up a lot more with that. But I'm just going to play another iconic bit of music from Ocean's 11. And, of course, we've really got to touch base on the Steven Soderbergh films. Not everyone likes them. Ocean's 11, 12 and 13 that Soderbergh started doing in about 2000. But I do. I kind of like the fact that they... It's a remake that I kind of think does well because it updates itself and it keeps the stuff that was good in the original and then embellishes it with other stuff. So Soderbergh's Ocean's trilogy I like because they do have the equivalents of the Sinatra type people. You know, you've got Clooney, you got Pitt, you got Matt Damon, Julia Roberts, yeah. But, you know, you do get a bunch of charismatic things. You've got Ellie Goulding in there. You've got Carl Reiner. I mean, yeah, your ensemble is fantastic. And that's one of the things I do like about Soderbergh's movies. When he puts it together, he does do a good ensemble. But anyway, here it is. Dean Martin singing "Ain't It a Kick in the Head" from Ocean's 11.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The room was completely black. I hugged her and she hugged back. Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in the boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. I've sunshine enough to spread. It's just like the fella said. Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head? That's a kick in the head. Ain't that a hole in the boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be
beautiful.
She's telling me we'll be wed. She's picked out a king-sized bed. I couldn't feel any better, or I'd be sad. Tell me quick. Oh, ain't love a kick. Tell me quick. Ain't love a kick.
Now, before we leave Ocean's 11, I really should mention Nelson Riddle's soundtrack to it. It's very, very cool space age pop soundtrack, that one. And Nelson Riddle, his movie soundtracks are fantastic, did a lot of arrangements for Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and Nat Cole and a bunch of other people. I mean, he is one of the great gods of lounge exotica kind of music, and in this one it's beautiful high energy. I mean, just the soul bass titles are very groovy as well at the start of the film, and that with the Nelson Riddle theme music with lots of brass and very kind of high energy stuff really brings you into the movie at the kind of cool hip level that you want to be at while you're watching this kind of stuff. And I find that really fun too. So just to wrap it all up in a bundle, it's just the coolest people on the planet making a movie at the peak of their careers. And, you know, a lot of them had sad later lives and issues and problems and conniptions and all sorts of weird and horrible shit later on. But at that time, they were where it was at. And really, it's a good movie to watch on a Sunday like this, where it's the weather's just broken and the storms are coming through, and you just want to have something cool and hip to watch with some really cool people in it. And yeah, I just had a thought about Angie Dickinson in this film. So excuse me if I'm digressing a little bit, because I do tend to do that, as you know. But Angie Dickinson actually brings a lot of class to that very small role as Danny Ocean's wife, Bee. She has a phone conversation with Patrice Wymore, which is very interesting. And she does stand up to the guys really well in this film, kind of the way she did with John Wayne in Rio Bravo. You know, she's the kind of female persona in movies that can hold its own against very strong male characters. And I think she's very underestimated for that. And, of course, she brought that into her TV series Policewoman as well, to a certain extent. But, yeah, Angie Dickinson is just a cool chick in general. So I'm going to take another break now and play another piece of music. And then we did have a piece of feedback, and I really want to get more feedback. So please, if you can, kultguru@gmail.com. You can leave a MP3 voicemail if you want to. You can go to the voicemail number in the States or anything else. But anyway, I'm going to take that break, and when I get back, we're going to be listening to Richard from Wichita again.
From the South there come stories about a girl who's quite a dream. The beauty of her race, though you doubt all the stories and think the tales are just a bit extreme, wait till you see her face. Tangerine, she is all they say, with masquerade eye and chapeau by dashay. Tangerine, with her lips aflame, if the color keeps Louis Philippe's to blame. I've seen clothes on Tangerine where the label says from Macy's Mezzanine. Yeah, she's got the guys in a whirl, but she's only fooling one girl. She's only fooling Tangerine. Tangerine, where the label says from Macy's Mezzanine. Yeah, she's got the guys in a whirl, but she's only fooling one girl. She's only fooling Tangerine.
That was Helen O'Connell with Tangerine. So we've got one voicemail. It's thinning out a little bit, and I am a bit worried about that, to be honest with you. From Richard in Wichita, and here we go.
Hey, this is Richard in Wichita, wanting to call in with just some quick comments and saying, first of all, as always, I'm loving the show. Just recently came back from a trip to Oklahoma to see my folks, and I always listen to podcasts, and it seems like I've always got at least one episode of Paleo Cinema to listen to, and for some reason, every time I go to Oklahoma, I crank that up and really enjoyed listening to your most recent episode. I like those waffling episodes, as you call them, you know, just basically shooting the shit about movies. It's a good for me, it's a good episode. I just really kind of enjoy those random topics. Had a couple of questions for you. Kind of curious what your thoughts are on Japanese, classic Japanese horror films. I've seen a couple in the last couple of weeks. Curious if you've seen them and maybe if you've got some recommendations for some other titles. I've had a chance to see the movie, and I'm going to butcher the name here, but I believe it's called Kuroniko. It's available on Criterion. One of the listeners over at the B-MovieCast mentioned it and caught my interest. I went ahead and bought it on Blu-ray, and it's a beautiful film, and it's creepy. It's just really engaging. It's very quickly become one of my personal favorites just because of its unique qualities to it. Really enjoyed it. That got me to kind of go through. I've got a great book called Japanese Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films by, I believe, Michael Galbraith, I think is his name. Galbraith, I know, is the last name. Very detailed book, and they had a title in there called The Ghost Story of Yatsuya that I managed to get off eBay. This is not commercially available here in the States, but, you know, got it through the usual sources. That one was definitely a little bit trippier, and it kind of surprised me a little bit, too. It was 1959. I was anticipating a black-and-white film and got color, which was pleasant, but, you know, not a bad film. I'm going to have to revisit about the second half of the movie, though, because it just kind of got a little trippy for me, and I want to make sure that I'm absorbing it. Wondered if you had a chance to see either one of those. They're typical Japanese ghost story, redemption, revenge movies kind of thing. So I wonder if you've seen those and maybe if you've got any similar recommendations. I'm definitely open to it. That particular genre is intriguing me. You mentioned the Dr. Mabuse films. Many, many years ago, I saw the German one. Was it The Testament of Dr. Mabuse in the early 30s? And was interested in it, but I've never seen any of the others. So looks like those are actually readily available here in the States, and I got an Amazon Kindle Fire for Christmas, and it looks like those movies can be easily rented through Amazon Prime. So I will hopefully get a chance to watch those at some point during this year. I've kind of put them on my to watch list. The huge stack of movies to watch, I'm never going to have enough time in my life to watch them, but I've always got time to add more to them. Wondered if you, and I don't think you've talked about this movie on your show, but Deadlier Than the Male, the 1960s Bulldog Drummond flick. Vince is going to cover this over at the B-MovieCast, and I just recently purchased it. It should be arriving in a couple of days, and it's got me kind of piqued my interest in some of the other 1960s spy flicks like that, and Our Man Flint and In Like Flint. I'm going to be revisiting those. I haven't seen those in probably 25 years or so. And I've never seen any of the Matt Helm movies with Dean Martin. And ironically, Turner Classic Movies just aired The Silencers, so it's on my DVR. I'm going to check that out. If I like it, I'm going to have to take the plunge and get that Matt Helm lounge kit. Set that's got all four movies. I know you love those 1960s spy flicks, and so for some reason the Dean Martin ones kind of skipped by me, but the In Like Flint and Our Man Flint played quite frequently on TV late 70s, early 80s, so I'm going to check those out. Love your segments that you're including of your radio show. I think that's kind of cool to kind of hear a more reserved Terry, to see the other side of you for the public consumption. But I definitely prefer the more, shall we say, unedited for podcast listening version of Terry Frost. But I do like the radio show that you're doing, and I think that's pretty cool that you're getting some national exposure like that. So I'm going to leave you there, just loving the show as always. And, you know, we're getting into Academy Award time, and quite frankly, I don't get into that here in the States. A lot of people do. I think that, generally speaking, a lot of the films they recognize sometimes are good, but sometimes they're just those artsy-fartsy films that are just, it's a matter of who you know to get nominated, and I don't get into a lot of what the Academy does, but, you know, I do kind of check out who they nominate and kind of interested to see who wins each year. I'm really hoping Hugo wins, but it doesn't stand a chance against some of its competition. That was my personal favorite from last year, and one of my all-time personal favorite movies. I just absolutely loved Hugo. All right, I'm going to leave you there, sir. Take care. Loving the show as always, and we will talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks for that, Richard. Great stuff there too, mate. I'm glad I'm helping you out with the drives, particularly down to Oklahoma. But, Japanese horror films. Heard of one, 64. It's a portmanteau film, kind of like Dead of Night and a bunch of the Amicus films. It's called Kwaidan. Now, having listened to your voicemail there, I'm acquiring, if you know what I mean by acquiring, a copy of Kwaidan, and I should be able to watch it before the next podcast, so I'll report back on that. I've heard great things about it as an anthology ghost story kind of film, but along similar lines, what I've been watching a lot of, and I didn't mention this at the top end of the podcast, is episodes of Rod Serling's Night Gallery. And they've got some great acting in there, particularly the episode with Elsa Lanchester and Cameron Mitchell. I recommend that one highly. But they kind of mix up horror and science fiction and comedy and scary stuff really well, and I'm kind of eating those by the handful at the moment and just enjoying them a lot. But I'm digressing a little bit there. Deadlier Than the Male, yeah, that and the sequel to it, Some Girls Do, both with Richard Johnson. Deadlier Than the Male I like because the Walker Brothers do a very groovy theme song to it. And I do like it. These movies have got Elka Sommer and people like that in it, so it's always good value. Sylvia Kashina. They are kind of lesser Bond wannabe films, but they do have a certain grooviness to them, and they're likable. Scott Walker from the Walker Brothers. Now, Scott Walker is one of my all-time favourite male singers. Scott Walker walked out of the movie because he didn't like it and didn't like the way their theme song was used. But I like the film, and if you can get any of Scott Walker's classic albums, they're good too. But, they're kind of 60s Euro spy kind of things and very much a genre that I like a lot. I'm going to have to pick up a decent copy of it. I've got a kind of slightly grey market DVD copy of Deadlier Than the Male. But for some reason, it won't play full screen on my DVD player. So I'm going to have to acquire another one. Because I do like the films. I think I did see them years and years ago. The ABC, the national broadcaster here, used to show movies all night. And now and then, Deadlier Than the Male and Some Girls Do would show up on those. And really good value stuff they are. All I need to say about these films is chicks in bikinis walking out of the Mediterranean waters carrying a spear gun. That's all you have to say. And people will watch the movie. So they are very, very groovy stuff too. Glad you're getting into the Mabusa films. And they are a little tough to get into just right at the start. Once you get into the headspace and the worldview, I think you'll find them really good. The Matt Helm films, don't expect too much from them, but they do have a certain tongue-in-cheekiness about them. I talked about the Flint films on the radio, and that went over really well just before Christmas too. So all of that Eurospy stuff is very, very groovy. But I'm glad you like me inserting the stuff that I get from Ivor as well. It is very different and it's more structured, and Ivor draws me back from my digressions a bit and does edit out a little bit of that occasionally comes up when we're recording, and I do appreciate that, and I appreciate the opportunity that it represents. So one of the other things too is that I might just be doing a monthly thing for the afternoon show in Darwin, where they want me to talk about the history and the careers of specific actors. So that's another possibility that's popping up for me in media as well, just while you were on the subject of the radio thing. Yeah, I kind of like the wild and free and easy rambling about film things. I don't know how many other people apart from you and myself enjoy those, but they are a nice digression, and I do like the unstructured stream of consciousness nature of them occasionally. And again, that was mostly because of that unexpected opportunity that came up to do it. But thanks, Richard. Thanks for all your support. And B-MovieCast is definitely a groovy podcast to listen to. Vince has a usual suspects round of people who turn up to do it. Mary and he do it with a wide range of co-conspirators. And of course, yeah, I've got to mention all the other podcasts I like. Love that album. Again, Morris, one of our great supporters here. If you're into contemporary music, a lot of the music he does isn't to my taste, but then I'm an old fart when it comes to music, and I'm unashamedly so. But he does a very fine podcast about where they look at the different album each time around. I do listen to it, and I learn a lot from it too when I do listen, but I'm not sure how in love I am with the albums compared to the way Morris is with them. Of course, Shooting the Pooh podcast, where three friends of mine just shoot the shit about popular culture in general. The Writer and the Critic is another one. Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, classic stuff. Mail Order Zombie is back. Dr. Zom is back on track, and Mail Order Zombie is much appreciated being back with us. And yeah, so that's about it for this time around on the podcast. Next time around, I've got no idea what I'm doing, but I'm going to do something. Just really want to find some new directions in a little bit. I do like doing the A to Z, but I find it constricting a little bit sometimes, because suddenly a movie will come up from somewhere else and I'll go, no, I can't use that yet, I've got to get the A to Z done. But yeah, the structure of the A to Z is kind of working but frustrating as well. But I may step out of that now and then and just kind of get things in a different headspace. But anyway, listen to good music, enjoy good films. I'll be back in 2 weeks with more of this kind of stuff, so take care of yourselves. Please offer feedback. I'm getting a little lonely here, and it's really horrible when your wife finds you crying in a corner, screaming they don't love me, and in general acting like a giant sook. But yeah, enjoy yourselves, and I'll catch you next time. Bye.